What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome again to Call to Communion here on EWTN. Delighted to have you along on this Thursday afternoon. This program is just for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters, and also for those of you who are Catholic. Maybe you've got a non-Catholic friend or coworker, somebody that you know that has questions about the Catholic faith, and you're not quite sure how to exactly answer those questions. Well, that's why we're here. Here's our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 58177. That's all you do. Put in EWTN, send it to 58177. You'll get an automated response from us. And then once you get that, then text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. You can also shoot us an email if you'd like. The address for that, ctc@ewtn.com. Our producer, Pedro Quiles, is off today. However, I must tell you, I'm never weary of Charles Beery. He's handling it today. Couldn't resist. Also, Matt Gabinski doing our phone screening, and I believe Ace McKay is going to handle social media for us today. If you're watching us on YouTube, you can put an email question, not an email question, but a question in the comments box. Ace will see that. He'll send it to us here in the studio. Love to answer your question on today's program. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
I'm well. How are you, sir?
That comment about Beery was worthy of, like, a famous American boxer from the 70s.
Oh, really? Nobody has ever mentioned me with Muhammad Ali in the same sentence, ever, ever, ever. But I'll take it. That's actually flattering. Thank you. Here's an email. This is one of these questions that pops up from time to time. This is from Tony. Dr. Anders, why can't women be priests? How do we know that wasn't something just for that age? A friend tries to tell me God gives different abilities to men and women spiritually, not just physically. He tells me that women are able to literally fall in love with Jesus and romantically love him and not just love him as God. But if he really loves women, why not let them preach? And again, that's from Tony.
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So before I jump into the complete answer, there was something in the question, a premise in the question that I think we need to challenge. If God really loves women, why can't he let them preach? Well, if by preaching you simply mean explicating the word of God in a hortatory manner to evoke conversion or moral transformation or love of God, in that kind of broad sense, obviously women do preach in the Catholic Church in that very broad sense.
Sure.
You know, I'm sitting in the middle of a Catholic radio and television network that was created specifically around the charismatic personality of a teaching nun who had a tremendous gift for expounding the Word of God and exhorting others to holiness. So
yes.
in that sense of the word, yeah, absolutely, the Catholic Church allows women to preach broadly conceived. Now, there's a very specific kind of preaching that takes place within the liturgical celebration that is restricted to the male-only priesthood because it's essentially connected to the rite of the holy sacrifice of the Mass. And the rationale for having men in that position is that in his liturgical function, the priest stands in relationship to the congregation, to the people of God, as Christ does, the husband to a bride, the father to a family. And so, you know, a woman can't be a father for an analogous reason that a man can't be a mother. You know, I mean, why doesn't the church allow men to become the superiors of women's monasteries? That's kind of a silly question.
It is.
You know? I mean,
it's, yeah.
That's a job. It's got nothing to do with the superiority of men or women or the respected gifts. So, I mean, I freely grant to you, there are probably an awful lot of women who, in a merely functional capacity, could probably exceed you know, the vast majority of men in the priesthood in things like parish administration or education or maybe even, you know, powerful, rhetorically engaging speech. I mean, any particular job that a man might do in the holy priesthood, there's probably a woman that can do that better in under some circumstances. But that's just not the qualification for ministry. I mean, sometimes I wish that, like, the Catholic Church had different criteria for calling people to ministry, right? Particularly when you see some of these guys get up and you're preaching, like, you did not take a speaking exam before you got into seminary, did you, bud? You know, no, that is just not the criteria at all. Mm. No, it isn't. It really isn't, right? There's a completely different model of vocation, because the principal job of a priest is to celebrate the sacraments, and most importantly, the holy sacrifice of the Mass, in which, again, he stands in relationship to the Church as a father to a family, as a husband to a bride. And so his iconic liturgical role requires the maleness of the office. But if you want to get down to the functions, if you want to know, can women be administrators in the Catholic Church? Yes. Can they be teachers in the Catholic Church? Yes. Can they give pastoral counseling in the Catholic Church? Yes. What they can't do is celebrate those sacraments that are reserved to holy orders.
All right. But
of course, I can't celebrate those either, and I'm male.
It is true. Well, there you go. And thank you so much for your question. If you would like to send us an email for a future show, here's the address, ctc@ewtn.com. Coming up on a break in a moment, but before we do that, I want to tell you about a wonderful book now available from EWTN Publishing, Mother Angelica, speaking of Mother Angelica's Keys to the Interior Life. In this beautiful collection, Mother Angelica teaches how to truly love and forgive amidst life's many challenges. She provides guidance on how to live Catholicism in the modern world and also grow in your personal relationship with God. With this spiritual master to guide you, you'll learn how to open up your heart to the gifts of the Holy Spirit and be filled with the courage you need to boldly live out your faith. It is fantastic. Amazing, amazing. Mother Angelica's Keys to the Eternal Life. Check it out at EWTNRC.com. EWTNRC.com. All right, in just a moment here, we're going to get to the phones, and hopefully we'll be talking with you at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Or, as we mentioned earlier, you can text the letters EWTN to 58177. Back in a moment with lots more Call to Communion here on EWTN. It's Called to Communion with Dr. David Anders on this Thursday afternoon here on EWTN. Phone lines are open for you at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. In a moment, we're going to be talking with Paul in Youngstown, Ohio. So hang in there, Paul. But for everybody else, if you're ready to turn around the State of the Union, well, the Reviving America Summit is just for you. Over 25 Christ-centered leaders reveal a 5-week roadmap for renewing faith, family, life, liberty, and leadership. It's going on right now, and that'll be through August 30th with powerful online sessions every day. Join David B. Wright and thousands of online believers to see and hear dynamic talks from Matthew Kelly, Bishop Mike Siss, Helen Alvarez, Jeannie Mancini from the March for Life, Mike and Alicia Hernan, Jeff Cavins, so many more. And you know what? It's absolutely free. Sign up for it right now by going to RevivingAmericaSummit.com. Did I mention it's free? I think I did. RevivingAmericaSummit.com. If you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN. Leading off with Paul, a first-time caller in Youngstown, Ohio, listening on the great Living Bread Radio. Hello, Paul. What's on your mind today, sir?
Hello. I am Eastern Orthodox, and I had a question about filioque.
Okay.
My question is this. I believe one of the popes, can't remember which one, John, maybe John the Eighth, said he could not add filioque to the creed because the creed was laid out by an ecumenical council. It could only be changed by an ecumenical council. Later, perhaps 200 years later, Rome did add it to the creed, and I wondered how they justified the change, but it seems to be about that time that they placed popes above the ecumenical council. Could you explain?
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So, you know, when you look at the doctrine of Petrine primacy, of course, Catholics allege to find the doctrine in Sacred Scripture and Gospel of St. Matthew, and you can find popes from the middle of the 3rd century explicitly claiming to sit in the See of Peter and to hold their position, you know, as a divine institution, not simply in virtue of their possession of the imperial see, but as descending from the apostles. And you can find that doctrine echoed not only in papal teaching, but you can find it echoed in other writings of the fathers, including Byzantine fathers and fathers outside of the Patriarchate of the West. And the idea that Rome is a final court of appeal is something that's common to ancient Greek-speaking, Coptic-speaking Christians, Arabic-speaking Christians, Chaldeans, as much as it is to Catholics. And the idea that the Pope could be a uniquely authoritative, faithful witness to the tradition to which a council might pay attention, it's evident at the Council of Chalcedon in the proclamation of Leo's Tome, and, you know, I'm sure you know the acclamation that he received. Peter has spoken through Leo, and therefore the council ratifies what he has to say. So there are a lot of ramifications and kind of sort of permutations, different modalities of understanding Petrine authority, in addition to and beyond the question of the composition of a creed. You definitely find a strong desire on the part of all parties to see that the Pope concedes to a creed. And of course, there have been councils that were purported to be ecumenical that didn't get traction because the Pope opposed them, right? And the way, I mean, even within Orthodoxy, my understanding of Orthodox ecclesiology is the way you determine after the fact whether a council was genuinely ecumenical or not. It doesn't have to do with the representativeness of the attendees, because, of course, some councils held to be ecumenical, you know, had sort of very narrow scope of attention. It's whether or not the thing was received by the church, right? That tends to be the way the ecumenicity of councils is accounted for within Orthodoxy. But that, of course, poses a difficulty, right? And that is, well, which church? And hence you have competing definitions of what counts as an ecumenical council within different strands of the Orthodox tradition. You know, witness, the Assyrian church versus the Byzantine versus the Egyptian. And of course the Catholic way of answering that question is that, of course, the final court of appeal again is the Bishop of Rome. And so, you can find in Maximus the Confessor, in other Byzantine thinkers, the explicit teaching about the need to concede whatever is held at Rome. I mean, that essentially is the court of final appeal. Now, you know, in terms of working out theologically, ecclesiologically, what are the implications of that doctrine of Petrine primacy and Rome as the final court of appeal and all that kind of thing? I would concede that there's been development in the way the church has understood that. And so, from my point of view, it's not an innovation; it's an entailment. It's a development of the doctrine of Petrine primacy, as always understood ecumenically by the Church. The Catholic Church recognizes a difference, a distinction between the Pope's teaching. This is something that's unique to Catholicism. You don't find the equivalent in Orthodoxy, obviously, between his ordinary magisterium and his extraordinary magisterium. And that is to say, we have a way of differentiating papal pronouncements as to when they're infallible and when they're not. And so it's perfectly conceivable for a pope to have a deficient understanding of his own office.
Mm.
There's nothing logically contradictory about that within the system of Catholic thought. And, of course, in formulating a dogma of infallibility, it's precisely these kinds of distinctions that the fathers of Vatican I draw upon, because they recognize that there were popes who, in their private theological teaching, if they weren't outright heretical, they were at least sometimes grossly imprudent. Honorius and the Monothelite controversy would be a case in point, And Catholics are perfectly well aware of these cases, and accommodate them within our own definition of infallibility.
Paul, thanks so much for your call. Don't be a stranger. Call us back another time. And that opens up a line for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for Dr. David Anders, 833-288-3986. Call to Communion on this Thursday afternoon here on EWTN Radio. Let's go to Peter in Los Angeles right now. Here is Peter listening on Sirius XM Channel 130. Hi, Peter. What's on your mind today, sir?
Yes, sir. Just was wondering, just a group of us Catholic men, or a few of the people in the group are converts to the faith in the last 12 to 24 months, and so we're kind of looking to read St. Paul's letters and kind of juxtaposition them to the Book of Acts in terms of his missionary. And what would be the, I'm just thinking, what's the best roadmap in approaching that? Because not too long ago, I think about a week ago or so, I think one of our group members was listening to your show and said that Dr. Anders made a comment in terms of when Paul wrote, was writing Ephesians. You know, that's where I'd like to understand from Paul, Dr. Anders, in the amount of time we have. He's writing Ephesians. He's over there in Galatia, or if he's writing, he's in Rome, he's in jail, he's over here, he's over there. Just to get a kind of perspective. But the comment that that was mentioned is that the Paul who wrote Ephesians wasn't the same Paul in the book of Romans. Change, is it the struggle? Is it the missionary? What was that related to in terms of the comment?
Yeah, sure. Thanks. I appreciate the question. So there are 13 letters ascribed to St. Paul in the New Testament, and the conclusion of most higher critical students of the Bible today, if you go into most departments of the New Testament in universities, and that would include Catholic universities, you'll find the preponderance of scholars are doubtful about the authentic Pauline authorship of all of those, right? And so there are 7 letters that are often called the undisputed letters of Paul. The other 6 are disputed, and a very strong case can be made that they couldn't have been penned by the very same author that wrote, say, Romans, Galatians, 1st, 2nd Corinthians. And on several grounds. I mean, there are very powerful linguistic grounds based on the way the Greek language is used, the kind of constructions, the vocabulary, the grammatical forms and stuff are very different between those, as well as there seem to be theological developments that don't mesh easily with the main themes of some of those earlier epistles. And so, you know, the way an Orthodox Catholic is going to handle that kind of historical study is to say, well, you know, I mean, okay, there can be, you know, pseudographical letters in the New Testament, and they were, you know, perhaps written by a disciple of Paul, or they were written by a Pauline community, and they were ascribed out of respect to Paul, and this kind of thing. And so, you know, the convention is to ascribe them to Paul. So on this show, I'll say, well, you know, when Paul was writing Ephesians. But if you ask me to put on my higher critical hat, you know, do I think that Paul took pen in hand and you know, wrote every word of Ephesians? No, I don't think so. That's not the conclusion of most scholars. And for that matter, even books like the Book of Romans has an inscription at the end where Paul's amanuensis says, you know, I wrote this in my own hand. Right? Mm. So Paul's dictating to somebody else.
Yeah,
and
this, yeah.
It's impossible to what extent was it, you know, Paul's, you know, word-for-word transcription, or is, you know, you understand the point that I'm making. So all that is to say, you know, there certainly have been plenty of attempts to coordinate the Pauline epistles, all 13 of those ascribed to Paul, with events in the Book of Acts. I'm skeptical of that, you know, for the aforementioned reasons and others as well. I think it's a perfectly legitimate enterprise to say, you know, say, how does the theology of Acts and the theology of, say, you know, 1 Thessalonians or something, mm-hmm. can we compare and contrast those? Sure, absolutely do that. But if you think, well, in order to properly understand the Book of Ephesians, that the right context for doing that is to go back and read the account in Acts of Paul's life in Ephesians, in Ephesus, rather. That, I think, is you're going to get less traction. So, you know, the Catholic Church has pretty specific teaching on the way to read the Bible. And, of course, we read all the scripture in light of the four senses of the Bible, which reduce basically to the literal and the spiritual. And the spiritual is the more important one. That's the one that actually effectively connects us to Jesus in our interior life. But the literal is understanding what the sacred author intended to convey within his own particular context. And, you know, if you're taking a letter that you think may be pseudographical, that it might have been written by somebody who was, say, a disciple of Paul or, a second or third generation Pauline church, then, higher critical scholars want to know what that context is, right? And that would help you determine what the quote-unquote literal sense of the text was. And then you use that to enlighten and illumine your understanding of the spiritual. In my approach to the writings of St. Paul, it's also perfectly legitimate to read St. Paul in light of the fathers and how they received St. Paul, recognizing that the church fathers can take the letters of Paul, and Paul will be sort of like a spur to their own creative theological invention, and so they may seem to find in Paul ideas that you're like, not so sure Paul said that, right? But as long as it's still within the bounds of orthodoxy, that's a legitimate way of reading. I mean, that's the way the New Testament reads the Old. It's kind of a spur that gets you thinking about things in the right direction.
Sure.
You can still sometimes run away in another direction without running off the borders of orthodoxy. So, for example, Augustine is the great medieval interpreter of St. Paul. Most modern scholars think that Augustine said things that, Paul probably didn't. Paul would have been a mess. Gosh, I didn't know I thought that, and yet you can still lawfully and legitimately and fruitfully read St. Augustine as he interacts with St. Paul. So if you pick up a book like Augustine's On the Spirit and the Letter, which purports to be an interpretation of Paul's teaching on works of the law and grace, inspired by the writings of St. Paul, you're going to find some difficulties. You're going to find some tensions if you read St. Augustine as if all he's doing is scientific exegesis of Paul. No, he's doing more than that. Right?
Okay.
In terms of understanding Paul on his own terms, I think it's a good idea to go hold of some commentaries and some studies on Paul to get at that literal sense a little bit better. There's a great little book by a non-Catholic Pauline scholar, N.T. Wright, called What St. Paul Really Said, which I think does a pretty darn good job of putting Paul in his historical context. Another little collection of essays, interestingly by a Lutheran scholar, but one that shaped my reading of Paul such that I became a Catholic, Christer Stendahl, his book Paul Among Jews and Gentiles. It was a big movement in mid-20th century Pauline scholarship to say, we need to read St. Paul in light of his first century Jewish context. N.T. Wright also has a biography of Paul the Apostle that does what you want to do, which is to try to understand Paul in that historical narrative. Mm. Now, he does talk about Acts, but he talks about other extra-biblical evidences as well. So if you really want to get a kind of a read on Paul's letters, as they fall chronologically and in historical context, I think N.T. Wright's biography of Paul, I think it's called Paul the Apostle, is probably as good a place to start as any.
Peter, is that helpful for you?
Yeah, I was just wondering, when the Catholic Church put the Bible together in 382, I guess that's the date. Did they have the same review as you did now in terms of, putting Paul in the right perspective in terms of his 13 letters?
Okay, yeah, thanks. So I said a number of things about Pauline perspective. So let's take the idea that you should read Paul in his ancient historical Jewish context. That actually is an extremely ancient idea that got lost and recovered, okay? So the second century fathers of the church, like when they were reading Romans and Galatians, absolutely had the idea, you have to read Paul against his Jewish background to understand what he's saying here. A modern book that makes that case is by Matthew Thomas called Paul's Works of the Law in the Perspective of the Second Century Reception. Did they have the same view of Pauline authorship? There were fathers in the ancient church who called into question the authenticity of some of the Pauline letters, but the preponderance of Catholic commentary, did not come to that recognition until the modern critical era.
Stay with us. It's Called to Communion with Dr. David Anders on this Thursday afternoon here on EWTN Radio. Still time for your call at 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for Dr. David Anders, Maybe you'd like to explain to us what is stopping you from becoming a Catholic. Well, 833-288-3986. Love to talk with you today. Hey, congratulations going out to another member of the EWTN radio family, Holy Family Radio, with two stations in Northwest Ohio, celebrating 14 years with EWTN. How about that? Congratulations to Deacon Jeff Compton and his great team there at Holy Family Radio from your friends here at EWTN. All right, Rihanna is watching us on YouTube this afternoon. Rihanna says, are there any good sources documenting the start and rise of Islam by contemporaneous Catholics?
Well, there are sources.
Okay.
As to how good they are, that's another question. So the earliest Christian sources on Islam, we have Coptic and Byzantine sources from the 7th century that are of dubious value, I think.
All right.
Probably the first early commentary on Islam and its theology with respect to Christianity that would be authoritative for Catholics would be John of Damascus, St. John Damascene, who's an 8th century Christian father of the church who lived and worked under the Islamic caliphate. So he was intimately familiar with it because he was sitting right in the middle of it, but he was a Christian.
Okay.
And so John of Damascus comments. And then, of course, Islam is a known quantity to medieval Christendom. And so, you know, theologians and missionaries deal with it more and more. In the 13th century, which is quite a bit later, there's a celebrated scholastic theologian named Raymond Lull, who became a missionary to Muslims in the North Africa. And of course, medieval theologians interacted with Islamic thought all the time. And particularly the Islamic philosopher Averroes prompted an awful lot of discussion in the 12th and 13th centuries. And St. Thomas Aquinas is the fellow who did the most towards understanding the proper integration of Arabic thought into scholastic discourse.
Okay. Well, there you go. Rihanna, thanks for watching us on YouTube this afternoon. Jack is listening in Orlando on Sirius XM, Channel 130. Hi, Jack. What's on your mind today, sir?
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. Just had a quick question on C.S. Lewis's writings and teachings. As a Catholic, is there anything that I should be wary of? And does he have any writings at all that venerate the Blessed Mother?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah. I really appreciate the question. So if you've listened to my show at all in the past, you might know that I have quite a bit of fondness for C.S. Lewis. I really like him a lot, and I've derived a great deal of benefit from him. But there are definitely things in Lewis that I take with a grain of salt. So probably one of Lewis's most famous works is a book entitled Mere Christianity, which began as a series of talks that he gave on BBC Radio, kind of unthinkable to imagine that BBC Radio might host those same talks today, during the war. And he meant to sort of give a summary of the Christian faith that was non-sectarian and non-denominational, to which, you know, all kinds of Christians might mm-hmm. subscribe.
Mm-hmm.
And while that book has helped a lot of people, I think Tom Moynihan credits that book with bringing him back to the Catholic faith. But anyway, it's helped all kinds of people, Catholics and not, like I myself have a little bit of a problem with the idea of, quote, mere Christianity, end quote, because it implies something that I think is integral to the theory behind modern denominationalism, and that is that there is this superstructure called Christianity into which the various Christian movements and denominations fit. And so that we're all sort of branches of the one big family.
Could he be using mere in an ironic way? As in, you know, like, well, it's only this, whereas it's enormous.
No. He was explicit about his use of the term, that he thought you could kind of mark out an essential core of doctrine that
uh-huh.
united all Christians.
Uh-huh.
And that, you know, getting that part right was the most important part, and the differences were secondary, right? And that's really not the Catholic view of ecclesiology or Christianity, right? The Catholic view is that there is a fullness to the faith
mm-hmm.
that is objectively discernible within the teaching of the Catholic Church, and there are formal boundaries of ecclesial membership that constitute the church that Christ founded. And so the whole idea that you can distinguish that from a kind of, ethereal, essential, quote-unquote, content is itself, you know, a problematic concept, regardless of how much good the book may have done over time, right?
Okay.
So that's one thing. Lewis, you know, he definitely Protestantizes a bit when you press him on, you know, matters of ecclesiology and devotion. So, you know, his spirituality as a Christian is biblical and liturgical, but definitely excludes, you know, devotion to the saints and this kind of thing. There's a beautiful passage in The Great Divorce, his novel The Great Divorce, which I love. I think it's a magnificent book, right? I mean, I highly recommend it. But the whole premise of The Great Divorce is these souls pass from some netherworld state that's ambiguous as to whether it's hell or purgatory into glory, and they're allowed to stay. The only condition is they have to want to.
Ah.
Right? And what happens is a lot of souls end up not wanting to because they have to give up their misery for joy. And sourpusses that we are, many times we cling to the things that cause us pain. So that's the point of the book, right?
I see.
But in the glory land, as it were, you know, the souls that stay and sort of fill up to the full measure in the life of grace become luminescent and beautiful. And there's a scene where C.S. Lewis is there. He's one of the characters in the book. He's being mentored. John MacDonald is his Virgil to, you know, to Dante's journey. And George MacDonald is over there next. Did I say George or John?
You said John.
Okay, John's a priest in my diocese. I meant to say George. George okay. MacDonald is there with him, and they look up, and here's this absolutely beautiful woman, just a shining, scintillating female character, with this enormous retinue that's giving her praise and honor and adulation, and she comes sort of traipsing by, and the Lewis character looks at the MacDonald character and he goes, Is that? And you know where he's going.
Sure.
You know?
Sure.
And the MacDonald character goes, oh, no, you know, her name was like, I don't know, like Sally or something. And she was a, you know, a washerwoman in 17th century Bristol, you know. And so, like, he teases you with this idea that, okay, here comes the Blessed Virgin Mary.
Uh-huh.
And you find out, no, it's some other virgin, you know.
Wow.
And that can't be. And that has to be deliberate on his part,
sure,
you know?
Sure.
And so there's little things like that that he drops, these little Protestant nuggets that he drops throughout the text that'll catch you, you know? And but in spite of that, there is in Lewis's sort of cosmological metaphysical vision something that is deeply and profoundly Catholic. And for me, one of the reasons that Lewis was a bridge to Catholicism is because in philosophy, as a philosopher of religion, Lewis Platonizes, right? There's a beautiful passage at the end of The Great Divorce at the end of The Last Battle, when all the characters from Narnia end up basically in heaven. And when they get there, they realize that the passage from Narnia to heaven, heaven looks a lot like Narnia, only more so. It's like somehow the mountains are taller and the skies are bluer and the sun is brighter and the fruit is sweeter and the people are more beautiful. And it's like Narnia 2.0.
Ah.
And as they journey inward, they found out that there's like another Narnia within Narnia within Narnia. It's like peeling back layers of the onion, except of getting, you know, more and narrower and narrower. It gets larger and larger. It gets bigger and bigger. And the idea is it wants both Platonistic, the idea that there's a kind of, you know, ideal immaterial reality to which the material world only corresponds. It's also deeply patristic, and it evokes the doctrine of epictasis that you find in St. Gregory of Nyssa, which is his view of an afterlife that's not static, but it's, you know, always, you know, onward and upward, more and more and more. This sort of accelerating, this infinite accelerating self-disclosure of God and the divine that never ends. And both those ideas are quite beautiful and attractive to me. And when the characters figure out what's going on, the image of the old professor, you know, sort of takes off his glasses and wipes them off and says, it's all in Plato. What do they teach them in these schools? Like what did you expect? What kind of heaven would you expect other than this sort of Neoplatonic one, right? And that kind of Neoplatonic vision of reality where moral qualities like truth and goodness and beauty and justice and courage are real entities in the world, and you know, in light of which we can judge our particular and our peculiar lives, that they're not just names we give to things, but they're real the real metaphysical qualities. I mean, that's a deeply, deeply Catholic idea that runs flat contrary to a great deal of Protestantism. And raised in the fundamentalist world that I was raised in, a very black and white, colorless and drab moral reality where good and evil were simply what God declared irrespective of my moral intuitions. And Lewis presented a vastly different view of the interior life and its relationship to the moral good that stood at odds with what I was learning in catechism class, even though I picked up Lewis in a Protestant church. And when I finally got to Catholicism and I picked up, say, St. Augustine, and I found it, you know, deeply imbued with the same kind of Neoplatonic vision, it was like I could breathe the deep air of transcendence and say, I've come home. And that's exactly the sentiment that the unicorn articulates when he gets to the Narnian heaven. He says, at last I have found my true home. This is where I was meant to be all along. You know, wow. That's how I felt in coming to Catholicism. And Lewis really kind of paved the way for me to get there through his metaphysical vision of reality. It was informed by medieval Catholic metaphysics. He has a book called The Discarded Image, which is all about medieval cosmology and the medieval worldview, which was discarded, right? That's why it's called The Discarded Image. And you can tell he knows that the modern world can't go back to that, but he has an evident nostalgia for it.
Sure.
You know, and it infuses all of his works. There's an author, I think his name is Michael Ward, who wrote a doctoral dissertation on the Chronicles of Narnia. Man, I wish I could be that guy for a day, right?
Yeah.
In which he argues that the seven Narnian books correspond to the seven planets of medieval astronomy. I mean, there's this kind of thing. They're going just woven throughout the Lewisonian corpus that fascinates me, never ceases to.
Very cool. Jack, thanks so much for your call from Orlando. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Last call for your call at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. We talk quite a bit these days about EWTN's Podcast Central because it is a fantastic platform to access some of the great Catholic podcasts out there. One of those is called On the Journey. On their latest episode, Matt, Ken, and Kenny share how they understood the Old Testament when they were evangelical Protestants and what they found when they began to look at what the Catholic Church teaches about it. You can hear this On the Journey with Matt, Ken, and Kenny. You can hear it and other faith-filled podcasts from our friends and affiliates all around the world, all in one place, all absolutely free. EWTN's Podcast Central. Just go to EWTN.com/radio. Once you're on that radio homepage, look for the words Podcast Central. Click there and you are good to go. In just a moment, we're going to get to the phones. A quick question here from Gabe watching us on YouTube this afternoon. Dr. Andrews, the Jehovah's Witness Study Bible has a Coptic 6th century translation of John 1:1 that implies the correct translation of God versus a God is in fact a God. Does this imply that some early Christians thought that a God was an acceptable translation?
Yeah, I really appreciate the question. So in early 4th century Alexandria, which of course is in Egypt, which is where Coptic was spoken, there was a presbyter, a priest, named Arius, who was a rationalist, and he recognized the long-standing Christian tradition that Christians should venerate Christ as God. But as a rationalist, he couldn't square that with the doctrine of God's unicity, the evident teaching that there is but one God. And so Arius came up with a novel idea. He said, I've got a great idea. I've figured out how we can square the unicity of God with the veneration of Christ as divine. Jesus is God in a lesser sense. That was Arius' contribution, in quotes, right? That was his idea, that as long as you acknowledge that Jesus is divine in a kind of lesser sense, he's a God, not the God, then you don't threaten the unicity of God. The doctrine of God's oneness is uncomplicated, and you can still venerate Jesus, but you're not confusing the two, and so voila, that solves the logical problem. And there were other rationalist thinkers that thought, you know, Arius is onto something here. We should start using this kind of language because it removes what has here, you know, up until now been a kind of mystery of the Christian faith. This makes us seem scientifically respectable. It caught on, particularly among a number of bishops, it caught on. But the rest of the church said, buddy, not so fast, because this really does not fit the Christian practice or intuition about venerating Jesus as divine. When we venerate Jesus as divine, we mean divine full stop. You know, capital G-O-D, period.
Yeah.
Right? That's what we mean. And Arius was deeply opposed in Egypt, especially by his bishop, as well as by another fellow by the name of Athanasius, who went on to become the Bishop of Alexandria and the great defender of Nicene Orthodoxy. The monks, they thought Arius was all washed up. They didn't like him whatsoever at all, couldn't stand him, in fact, and they came out hard against him. And so, you know, the common Christian people, they weren't going in for Arius. And the ecclesiastics weren't either. And so eventually the church held an ecumenical council in 325, and the Arian position was anathematized, and it was rejected as heresy. Now, that didn't stop it from sticking around. So the Vandals, you've heard of the Vandals, is where we get the word vandalize from.
Sure.
It's a barbarian group that, came over from Spain. When they made their way into Rome and they were Christianized, they adopted Arian Christianity. And so you had big period in the Middle Ages where you had, you know, the Orthodox party, and then you had these barbarian warlords that were beating up on Catholics that were Arians. Arianism died out again in the Middle Ages, and it was revived in the 16th century by radical Protestant thinkers like Servetus and Faustus Socinus. They were early modern rationalists. And then again it reared its ugly head in the 18th century in the Unitarian movement. So people like William Ellery Channing in Boston, founder of the Unitarian movement, were Arians. And then it popped up its head up again in the 19th century when Charles Russell, who founded the Jehovah's Witnesses, learned just enough Greek to be dangerous, just enough Greek to be dangerous. It's telling that the most viciously vociferous Trinitarian Christians on the entire planet are Greeks. Say that again. The most vociferously Trinitarian Christians on the entire planet are Greeks, right? And the New Testament was written in Greek, not in Coptic. Go over to Greece and run around and tell them that you know the proper interpretation of the Greek meaning of John 1:1. Let's see how that flies for you. Just give that a shot. See what your typical Greek Christian in Greece has to say about the Greek meaning of John 1. And you'll find that the Arian view is not going to hold water in Greece, all right, or among Greek scholars. There is a trick of predication, the way that you say this thing is that. That's what it means to predicate in Greek, and what it implies about the use or the absence of articles, like the article the, okay? And in Greek, there isn't an article for a. There's not there's the definite article. You don't have the indefinite article, yeah. And there are rules about when you use the definite article and when you don't. And when the definite article is implied versus when it has to be stated. And in other cases, with the lack of the definite article, you can translate the indefinite article. You can turn, you know, the into a. But you've got to follow the right procedures to do that, right? And Russell knew just enough Greek to know that the lack of a definite article can sometimes imply that you should translate a versus the. And so he goes, aha, I found the key to John. But he didn't. He didn't. He just knew enough Greek to be dangerous. If he learned a little bit more, he would have learned that he wasn't following the proper rules of predication and the use of articles in Greek. And so the God is the proper translation, not a God. But in answer to the question, were there Coptic Christians that were Arians? Yeah, of course. That's why we had the Council of Nicaea, to point out to them that they were dead wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then, you know, the argument that my group is right because some ancient Christian believed the way we believed takes no account of the whole idea of orthodoxy.
Yeah.
Right? The whole idea of orthodoxy is that there is a correct interpretation of the Christian faith that can be differentiated from incorrect versions. There have always been incorrect versions. You know, in the New Testament itself, the New Testament bears witness to heretical understandings of the person of Jesus. So Paul says in Galatians, if anyone preaches to you a gospel other than the one you have received, that means that people were preaching gospels other than the ones that they had received, then let him be anathema, right? So there have been heresies, there have been misinterpretations of the Christian message from within the lifetime of the apostles. That doesn't mean that they were correct just because they were ancient.
Right. And there it is. Gabe, thanks so much for watching us on YouTube this afternoon. Here is Holly now in San Antonio, listening on the great Guadalupe Radio. Holly, what's on your mind today?
Yes, thank you. I am wondering, Dr. Anders, if you have any resources for the historical life of Jesus, like scientific proof that he actually lived. And the reason that I ask is that my husband is agnostic. I was hoping to present him with something he could wrap his sciencey brain around, and maybe that would lead him to further investigation.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. So I like what you want to do. You're trying to prompt your husband to think about the possibility of the truth of the Christian faith. You want to know if proving the historical existence of Jesus is the way to go. And do I have resources that could help you do that? So I do think it's a good idea to prompt your husband to think more deeply about the truths of the Christian faith. Yes, I can give you historical sources that prove that Jesus was an actual historical person. However, I don't think that's the best avenue to take with your husband. So let me expound, okay? You may or may not know, one of the best-known atheist biblical scholars in North America today, I mean, he's if you say his name, and anybody who is into this sort of thing knows the name immediately, but he's a kind of notorious atheist, is the former evangelical scholar Bart Ehrman. Ehrman's name is kind of a household name among people that are interested in the popularization of biblical scholarship. Ehrman is an atheist. He clearly doesn't believe that Jesus is the Son of God who rose from the dead, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He certainly doesn't believe in the Catholic faith. But Ehrman wrote a pretty compelling book did Jesus exist? And he answers in the affirmative. I mean, there's a very small number of biblical scholars and historians called mythicists that hold that there was no person called Jesus Christ, that he's an invention of the later Christian church. And Ehrman, who is not a Christian and he's not a believer, says, you know, that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. And he writes a pretty compelling book about how we know there was a guy named Jesus. But of course, it didn't persuade Ehrman that he was the Son of God. Just to acknowledge that Jesus existed doesn't really get you where you want to go, right? So I'm gonna suggest a completely different tack, okay? With someone who is an atheist and probably a materialist, I think the first step is to challenge the idea that materialism is true, right? I don't want to get to Jesus yet. I want to just open the door to the possibility that there is an immaterial world, okay? And for that, I'm going to suggest a completely different book, and it's a book by an atheist, which should be disarming for an atheist. The author is named Thomas Nagel, N-A-G-E-L, and the title of the book is Mind and Cosmos. And it is a book by an atheist on why materialism and the modern materialistic neo-Darwinian synthesis is almost certainly wrong. And Nagel doesn't make his way to theism, he doesn't make his way to belief in God, but he makes his way to belief that matter is not all there is, that there is something in reality beyond matter, and in fact that there has to be in order to explain what we know about the nature of reality. I'll give you another book that is by a Catholic. This one is, the author is named Edward Feser, F-E-S-E-R, and the title of the book is The Last Superstition. The Last Superstition. And it's a philosophical book about proofs for the existence of God and why materialism is almost certainly false. So I'd start with those two books, and then we'll get to the historical Jesus and the founding of the Catholic Church later on. But if a fellow doesn't believe in God, then persuading him that there was a guy named Jesus isn't going to give him faith in God, right? I mean, you have to have, it's not enough to believe that there was a man named Jesus. We want him to ultimately come to believe that Jesus was the Son of God. But to get there, you got to concede that there can be a thing called God.
Yeah. Is that helpful for you, Holly?
Yeah, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. And it's always good to say, well, we can do this, but maybe this other path might get you to where you want to go, certainly a little bit quicker.
Quicker, more efficiently. Yep.
Sure. All right. Holly, thanks for checking in from San Antonio. Very glad that you're listening on our great partner, Guadalupe Radio. Fantastic program today. We got a lot of phone calls in, got some emails in, got some texts and some chats from YouTube. I'd call that a pretty successful program today. Dr. David Anders, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Tom.
We do this Monday through Friday right here on EWTN Radio at 2 p.m. Eastern. You check out podcast anytime you wish by going to the aforementioned Podcast Central. Again, how to get there? EWTN.com. Click on the radio box and then look for the words Podcast Central. On behalf of our fantastic team, including Charles Beery today, I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Anders. Thanks for joining us. Look forward to seeing you tomorrow on the Friday edition of Call to Communion here on EWTN. Have a great day and God bless.